Welcome to Ballistic Radio. Join us as we discuss hard-won self-defense lessons, as well as the information you need to survive a violent encounter. Listen as armed professionals, industry experts, national champions, and gunfight survivors help answer all your firearms and self-defense questions while exploring your rights and responsibilities as an armed citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. And now, here is your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better! I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com. Get the latest behind-the-scenes info, arguments, photos, videos, other stuff, throwbacks to the 80s at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me, Jack!
Yay!
Co-host Boop!
Boop!
Never mind. I don't even want to talk about that. We're time traveling again, Jack.
I hate time travel so much.
I actually prefer time traveling.
Well, I mean, I hate that you bring it up constantly, so I'm always have to think about, like, when past Jack hears future Jack and...
Are you past Jack now or future Jack then?
See, there becomes the problem. Either way, I'm hungover Jack.
Ah. You know what made me happy?
What's that, John?
Watching you punch yourself in the eye with your headphones as we were getting set up in the studio.
I'm glad that made you happy. I know that...
Hey, when somebody asks, just make sure I walked into a door.
Oh.
Hey, guess what, Jack?
What's that, John?
This segment brought to you by Tactical Night Vision Company. The night is dark and full of terrors, or at least it used to be, but now we have the technology to fight the night, and TNVC is your one-stop shop for all your dark fighting needs. From the TNV PVS-14 Night Vision Goggle to the IR Patrol Thermal Monocular and everything in between, TNVC can outfit your defense against the dark arts. Doesn't matter if it's your lost keys, the enemy, or that little kid from down the street that likes to wander off, TNVC has what you need to find things in the dark. TNVC now with financing. Own or finance tonight. And you know what the awesome thing is?
What's that, John?
Dr. William April is joining us.
The Dr. William April?
I just like to call him The William.
The William.
Because no one else is as notable or anyway. Joining us, The William. How's it going, man?
Very well. How about you guys?
Oh, can't complain. I could, no one would care, and I'd probably do it pedantically, and then somebody would make fun of me in a class.
You know, the beauty of it is, if you really master time travel, you can go back and watch Jack hit himself in the face with the headphones over and over and over.
Oh, I'm already replaying it in my mind, like one of those highlight reels, you know, because the best part of it was actually not when he did it, it was the look on his face after he realized he did it, when he wasn't sure if I had seen him do it or not. But it's okay. I have the feeling a frost giant fist is going to hit me in the eye on accident in a little bit, and then I
accident is such a funny word,
right?
It implies no one's at fault.
Mm.
Which, when this happens, you know it'll be your fault.
My fault. That's right. So I've had you on the show a lot. Would you like me to do your intro for you? Because I know you hate them.
I do. I hate it. But if you must, feel free.
So you're a mid-career mental health professional that also spent some time.
I'm actually in my 20th year of doing that now. Time flies when you're having fun, I guess.
Right? Right. I was also spent some time in law enforcement and did a bunch of training with a bunch of people that are famous for being really good trainers. Wow, it's so much better than when you do it. Do you want to do it? You should probably do it.
Sure. I'm a mid-career mental health professional from New Orleans, Louisiana, actually in my 20th year of doing that. I have a private practice right now where I work in a general mental health practice, but a fair bit of work with folks with post-traumatic stress disorder. I was a sheriff's deputy here in my hometown and also worked for the U.S. Marshal Service in the Eastern District of Louisiana as a special deputy U.S. Marshal. I got into the training industry in the late 80s just by taking classes like everybody else and just proceeded on from there and taught for a bunch of different notable folks over the years and then basically under my own shingle for about the past 5 years.
Nice. Nice. So I've had you on the show a lot. I've taken a lot of training with you. One of the most recent classes that you're involved in that I've gotten to go and experience was actually the Establishing a Dominance Paradigm that you teach with Craig Douglas and Tom Givens as well. And we're gonna talk about that actually for the next two shows a little bit. But can you tell me what that class is and what the impetus was behind it? And then I'm going to share a quote that really struck me from the...
Yeah, well, it got started, a discussion that Craig and Tom Givens and I were having about a class where we were... It was designed to be demanding and to press people in ways they don't get pressed in very much training. Because the goal is just like the name sounds, the goal is to try and break people through to a performance level where we not only expect them to survive a lethal force encounter or win unquote a lethal force encounter, but to consciously and explicitly aim for dominance in that kind of environment. And it sounds a little weird because and it struck the three of us that most of the training is. Almost instilling a notion that you're going to be completely overwhelmed and barely able to function, and if everything goes right, hopefully you'll live.
Right.
Well, if we can all expect, though, that there's going to be serious degradation of skills and serious degradation of performance under stress, if you're aiming at mere survival and fall slightly short, you die. And so we started thinking, well, we need to shoot quite a bit higher, have your aim exceed your grasp so that... in this kind of environment, you actually have enough, I hate to say extra, but extra skills, extra capacity to perform that you can rise far enough above to do as much as you can to guarantee the outcome goes your way.
Well, and that's, I'd heard about the class. This was the third year that you guys have taught it. It was the third year, right? Third?
Yeah.
I'd been wanting to go, hadn't had the opportunity, and things just worked out this year and that I was able to. And it was what struck me about it. There were actually quite a few things that struck me about it, but I hadn't ever really considered before the kind of the social component. We're talking about not just surviving, but actively dominating a fight is almost... There's sort of a taboo there, like, whoa, that sounds, you mean you're the aggressor or whatever? And that's not exactly what you guys are talking about, right?
Right. And, that I think people tend to think about that. It is almost a taboo because, there's certainly no desire to go have an unnecessary conflict. But the world tends to take care of that for us.
Right.
The world sets up what it's going to set up. But, there's an old cliche that if you're reaching for the stars and fall short, at least you still get the moon. And performance isn't that much different. I mean, you're not training to think that I can just barely do what it takes to survive.
Right.
And so the mindset of sort of breaking out of the box of thinking of bare performance. Is a tough one to get through because people tend to think, oh, we're going to very quickly get arrogant and talk about starting lots of fights and I can't lose. You were there.
Yeah.
We certainly don't try and instill a sense of false confidence. Far from it.
No. And I would, I recently posted something on my private page and you commented about it, but I'm up around like 1,300 hours of private instruction now, and I'm a lot less sure of, not myself, but like what I think and what the answers are than I was at 200 hours of instruction. And that's something I'm really proud about, is just because like the more I see, the more I realize there is to see. And you were discussing, a lot of people have called it a circle of a circle of competence, but it's actually a spiral of competence. We got about a minute left. If you want to comment on that real quick, and then we'll hop into the next segment.
Well, sure. People think of it as a circle to move from, unconscious incompetence to conscious incompetence to conscious competence to unconscious competence. but it's not a circle, meaning that you're not rotating around issues at the same level. It's a spiral, because every time you go through that cycle, you appreciate material at a higher and higher level, and you see more and more things that you don't know. You are higher up. You've moved higher up. You're sort of standing on the framework of what you've accomplished, but you now see there's a whole bunch more stuff to accomplish that you simply didn't appreciate existed before.
Right.
So it's really a spiral, not a circle.
We'll get into that. We got to go to break. We're talking with Dr. William April, and right now you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Sig Sauer, now with more options. We're not all the same, and our carrying gun shouldn't have to be either. Sig Sauer gives you choices, and with more models than the Bible's got Psalms, it's never been easier to find a Sig Sauer that fits your needs. From the extremely versatile striker-fired P320 with a modular grip frame, to the Legion Series P226, the single-stack P225A1, or the entry-level SP2022. Sig Sauer makes a model that's right for you. Just don't ask for a Callahan full-bore auto-lock. They don't make that yet. Sig Sauer, when it counts. So we are joined by Dr. William April, and we are talking about establishing a dominance paradigm, which we promise is not some weird thing. You want to keep listening. Before the break, we were talking about the spiral of competence, how it's not a circle, but as you become more and more familiar with a skill or a topic or whatever, you're standing on the framework of what you've already accomplished. And hopefully, if you're any sort of introspective, you can go, wow, there's a lot more to learn about this. Kind of maybe.
Oh, absolutely. It's funny. In my sort of day job, it's a concept that we're up to our hips in all day. People in therapy tend to go over the same material repeatedly in sort of different domains of their life, but that hopefully they're doing it with greater and greater understanding every time.
Right.
But what you'll see often in performance, especially in kind of the self-defense context, is, you know, there's a cliche about people who don't learn from their experience. It says, the so-and-so doesn't have 10 years of experience. They have 1 year of experience 10 times.
Huh.
Thinking of it as a spiral of competence, it really encourages you to look both backwards, where you were and what you thought was important then, and where you are now and what you can think is important now, because you can see much further into the future. It's a little bit like shooting performance. The first time you do something you couldn't do before,
right.
It's sort of miraculous. I did that. Wow, I can see the Matrix. but then hopefully that becomes your new baseline, and you can see all the things that you now can't do yet, but that you think you might be able to with enough kind of application. So it's a really important concept, and that's why we start. You know, I was so happy to hear you refer to it the other day, and it's a good place for a lot of people to start thinking about where they need to go.
Well, and I have to say, thank you so much for putting up with me for the last 5 years, because I look back at, you know, because I met you at the first Pollypalooza, which was, what, 5 years ago? Coming up, geez. And
wow.
Yeah, right? And I look back at kind of how I mean, not that I act much better, I just act annoying in a different way, but... the fact that you and everyone else has put up with me for this long, thank you. I apologize. I meant well. So one of the things that struck me about the class, the very first, in the classroom presentation, the very first thing that you have up on the screen is a quote from Dietrich Dorner, which is, "Failure does not strike like a bolt from the blue. It develops gradually according to its own logic." What does that mean to you, and why should we consider that?
Well, it's from his book, The Logic of Failure, and it struck me when I read it as an important way of it really knits together two things that I think both of which need to be kept in mind. One is that when we fail at anything, at any kind of complex endeavor, it's due both to circumstances outside of our control and circumstances within our control. And it's a particularly devilish knitting of those two things together that I think really causes the most trouble for people in the defense industry. you know, Dr. Derner was a professor of psychology in Germany, and you know, the subtitle of his book is really important: recognizing and avoiding error in complex situations. And what he's basically saying is that, you know, the world is going to deliver its own input into your endeavors, right? Sometimes the world just makes it so that you fail. But that a lot of times it's our own problems in dealing with the world and dealing what the world gives us. You know, the second part of that quote that I love so much is that he says, when we watch individuals attempt to solve problems, meaning when the person has chosen to interact with the world to try and get an endeavor done, we will see that complicated situations seem to elicit habits of thought that set failure in motion from the beginning. And at the beginning of the EDP class, I boil it down by saying, if you get killed in a self-defense encounter, that's a process that likely started long before that moment in time, where habits of thinking that I'll need this and I won't need that, that I'll need to be able to do this and I won't need to be able to do that. And those decisions have consequences. And even though we make them so far in the past, we don't remember making them, and we certainly don't remember making them as conscious decisions, they bear fruit. And those fruit are sometimes toxic.
Do you, I mean, for us, for, you know, I hate using the word us because I don't like creating groups like that, but for self-defense-minded individuals, what do you think the biggest breakdown in thinking is? I mean, is it predetermining what a violent encounter is going to look like? And then if it doesn't look that way, you don't know what else to do? Or is it, I mean, what should we be concerned with? Or what do you think is the issue, the largest issue? And then we can break it down.
Well, if I could, you know, sort of nail one to the wall that I think is the most concerning, is that we get confused between the description of events and prediction of events.
Okay.
You know, it falls very neatly into, you know, that conscious cognitive structure that we have of things called a schema. It's sort of a map of things. You know, like your map of Monday is, you know, pretty much like the Monday that came before it. The Monday that came before that, and the Monday that came before that. And those maps are perfectly accurate until the Monday where one of your coworkers chops off the head of another one of your coworkers in the break room, like happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Right.
That Monday is completely off your map. And so the inability to conceive of it makes us think that next Monday can't be any different than this past Monday. I'm using the same map over and over and over again. But in my mind, I'm not thinking, boy, have I gotten lucky that hasn't happened yet. I'm not able to keep that thought in the front of my mind. And what instead comes out is, this is what every Monday will be like.
Okay.
Or even worse, if there is a problem, the only problem that will arise is a problem that I know how to handle, that I'm capable of handling, that I'd actually hope would happen. You know, we've all talked with you know, gun people, if you will, people in the self-defense way of thinking, who actually are hoping something bad happens.
Right.
They have a strange vision of themselves saving the day with a pistol or something like that. And they almost never imagine one that's beyond their capacity to handle.
Right.
They imagine problems that are right in the wheelhouse. And that, to me, is just incredibly dangerous because we don't get to predict what happens. You know, as Tom Gibbons says, a gunfight is a come-as-you-are event, not come-as-you-wish-you-were.
There's so many different ways to go with this. Do you think the fact that the typical shooting problem is not that difficult overshadows how difficult a self-defense scenario, especially one that's got ambiguity in it, can be?
Oh, I think absolutely, yeah. If you break them down almost like stages in a pistol match, you know, a lot of shooting problems that could be solved by people, you know, in the kind of concealed carry mode are not that challenging.
Right.
But it's the recognition that's challenging. It's the ability to get back below the shock threshold when something unusual happens and get into problem solving. Then it's the mechanics of gun handling under stress, a clean draw, a clean presentation, all that good stuff. It's those that are tough and that, you know, actually shooting the gun in the time and accuracy parameters required isn't that tough, but it's getting, it's the delivery system that brings that psychomotor skill into play that breaks down so often.
Well,
you, you know, you'll regularly see events that, that the person on the range playing around could handle no sweat, but they can't do it in real life.
Huh. We'll talk about that a little bit more. We've got to go to break again. We're talking with Dr. William April right now. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer. By Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat making the finest custom machine weapons and scatterguns since 1977. Legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories at www.wilsoncombat.com. And I have to say, the fact that Wilson Combat has allowed me to wrestle as many Jimmies as they have by sending me that pistol caliber carbine is just amazing.
You would have thought you kicked a puppy on the internet with that thing.
Yeah, it's like, you know, this is a viable option if it's what you got. No, you'll get killed on the street. Well, I'm in my house. The streets!
You know, pistol caliber carbine seemed to work at Princess Gate.
I don't get the reference, and that scares me.
The Iranian embassy.
Thank you.
They didn't even use stocks or sights.
Anyway, on that note, geez, Jack. Yes, you win. You got one. So we have a standing bet where one of us will drop something on air, and if the other one doesn't get it, what is it, a dollar?
Uh-huh.
I usually win that bet. I don't like it when I don't. Anyway, we're joined by Dr. William April. And before the break, you were sort of discussing how the shooting's not necessarily the problem, but the delivery system is. And you brought up something, the shock threshold, and you specifically said, you know, overcoming the shock threshold. What is that for people that aren't aware, and why should it matter to us?
Well, the way I think of it is, you know, if there's a relationship between stress and performance. Stress tends to increase performance until it doesn't. The way I look at it, stress is like water. Water is the critical thing, and we all need and love water until right about nose level. Then it stops being good and starts being bad.
Right.
A shock threshold is a level of arousal that doesn't allow for performance. Not only doesn't it let performance get better, it decreases performance dramatically. And so getting back, you know, the body alarm reaction that brings us above a shock threshold, so to speak, is caused by something startling and dangerous in the environment. Drivers, people who do really well under that life-threatening stress, are people who very quickly are able to get back below the shock threshold and not only start analyzing what's going on, but start performing and start doing things that solve their problem in real time. You know, and that's something that can't be trained out of us. We each have our own shock threshold, though exposure can change it over time. I mean, if you work in demolition for a living, you stop noticing explosions going off.
Right.
You know, they've really got to be compelling to get your attention, just like gunfire. I mean, the first time you bring an absolute beginner to an indoor range, every time someone else shoots a gun, they jump. Well, yeah. After a while, that stops happening. But the shock threshold is pretty much part of your temperament, your sort of pre-installed way of being in the world. But you can very quickly learn to get under it as quickly as possible so that you can function, start solving the problems right away.
Is that just familiarity with something, or how would you...
Well, it's interesting to bring that up because a lot of times it is. What's an interesting version of shock threshold is, let's say, an experienced shooter shooting a very high-quality firearm that they know works. When it malfunctions, the level of shock is something to behold. Huh. Because you would think there'd be this instantaneous, you know, tap rack, proceed, you know, resolve this problem. Instead, what you'll often see is experienced shooters staring at their really good gun like a monkey staring at fire. They simply cannot comprehend what's happened because they're so familiar with that gun and their own skills, and they expect both to work seamlessly.
Right.
So we've got to overcome, to a certain extent, that familiarity effect and say, sure, I expect it to work, but it's a gun, and guns break. They they malfunction, they misperform, so to speak. And so it's not something that can be erased by experience or exposure.
Well, and that's, I'm thinking back to the last TAC conference where Spencer Keepers and I were doing a shoot off against one another, just like a draw to shot. And he actually hit a round where the primer was loaded backwards in the round when he draws to shoot. And there's slow motion video of this. The look he gives his gun when it doesn't go off. And I mean, he beat me like a lot, like bad, like real bad. He beats me on the draw. He gets a click instead of a bang, and you see his face just kind of go, huh? And I'm like,
yeah,
it's like, what are you doing?
It's just, it's almost a look of betrayal. Because, if you trust yourself well enough and you trust your equipment well enough, and then one of them lets you down, it's almost just this part of you it strikes it as unbelievable. I can't believe this is happening to me. Very, very quickly to get back out of that and get into, well, it did happen, and now here's what I have to do to fix it. That's managing that shock threshold.
Ken, you relate a story about a pilot friend of yours that had a catastrophic failure, and I thought that was interesting, kind of his reaction. I don't know if you...
It is interesting, test pilots. There's been lots and lots of interesting research done about test pilots because... If you think about it, it's a nightmare of a task to take on. I'm going to fly a plane and I don't know if it works. I don't know if this plane can actually do what I need it to do. And so they go up with the expectation that unexpected catastrophic stuff is going to happen. And they have to get about the business of solving it in timeframes that almost seem unbelievable, almost seem impossible. I know I mentioned during the course that, one of the, kind of movie characters that just really puts the hook in people is Jason Bourne, from all those Jason Bourne movies.
Right.
But the thing that really makes him, I think, stand out on film and what really captures our imagination is that he's never startled into inaction. He's always solving his problems instantaneously.
Yeah.
That there's a little creative license there, I'm sure. People can do that, and that's what's so startling. When they have great depth of expertise in a certain area, the example was of a test pilot where the wing of the plane failed, and it failed internally because one of the structures holding it on. And as he's sort of plummeting to the ground, it dawns on him that he remembers the schematic of how the wing is constructed, and it dawns on him that if he flies the plane upside down, fully inverted, that the wing will sort of fall back into place. And he pulled that off, and to hear him describe it was fascinating because the way he described it, at that point, all was well,
yeah.
Even though it wasn't. But what he meant was that the most critical problem had been addressed for the moment, which meant he had earned the time to find the solution to the next problem. And breaking it down into that sort of segmented process, here's a problem, here's what I can do to fix it. Aha, here's the problem after that, and let me think about what I can do to fix it. The ability to start that process, as opposed to standing around thinking, why is this happening to me, is what separates people who thrive from people who fail, people who live from people who die.
So is that just overlearning a task or overlearning multiple tasks to the point where if you need to do something, it doesn't require much conscious effort to do what needs to be done, and you're able to think your way through it, or is it more than that?
Well, there has to be what we call a fund of knowledge, right? So there's like this deep pool of knowledge about that subject. I mean, if he didn't understand how that plane was physically built, the solution to his problem wouldn't have appeared to him. It simply couldn't have appeared to him.
Right.
So there's a depth of knowledge that's there, but it's the systematic delivery system that really works there. That's what solves the problem, is his ability not to panic, but instead to very quickly start doing things that are generally adaptive, meaning not to the specific task, but generally adaptive, but then doing things that are specifically adaptive to solving that particular problem. and you know, some of that is temperamental. There are people who are simply overwhelmed by life-threatening stress and will just, in a very static state, be overwhelmed by it.
Huh. We'll get into that a little bit, and that'll actually probably lead in well to the next show we're going to do, too. Right now, we're talking with Dr. William April. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Surefire. Know your target and what is beyond it. But how can you really know your target? By shining a really bright light at it, and that's where Surefire comes in. From the USB rechargeable 300 lumen Sidekick to the 500 lumen X300 Ultra or M600 Scout Light, Surefire can make sure you never have to yell "Aziz light" ever again. Doesn't matter if you're shining a light at a potential threat or just helping your friends see through their eyelids. When you need all the lumens for longer, you need Surefire. And now is a special offer to Ballistic Radio listeners. You can get 30% off everything at the Surefire.com web store, except for batteries and suppressors, by entering the discount code ALLTHELUMENS. That is ALLTHELUMENS, no space, at Surefire.com. So we're talking with Dr. William April, and we were discussing being able to think through problems and having knowledge to draw from, but actually a delivery system to work through that, and how some people are just crippled by life-threatening stress. Is that like an adaptive characteristic from, you know, somewhere in our evolutionary past, or is what's that about? Because it does.
Absolutely. I mean, anything that you know, we all manifest the traits of genetic winners. Genetic losers didn't survive to pass us on their traits. And the trait of being able to process information very, very quickly and get about saving of your own life very, very quickly is absolutely one that increases survivability, and so those genes are going to get passed on, so you're going to see that trait. But it is funny that you use the word think through. And when people say think through a problem, what they're talking about is a conscious process of mapping a response.
Right.
Well, that's great when you're setting about making a cake or planning out your daily schedule, or I'm going to fix my car. So we can set up a series of things that need to happen. I need to lay out the tools. I need to have a nice workspace. I need to jack the car up. I need to do those certain things. Crisis doesn't allow for that.
Right.
And so it doesn't rely on that kind of segmented process, that kind of wonderfully planned out sequential process that our conscious mind just loves to do and is really good at. Instead, it requires a lot of processing that's subconscious. Are the rest of our mind, the kind of baked-in threat detection and threat response systems, those have taken over. And often our conscious mind is really relegated to the role of the stopper of those behaviors, not the instigator of those behaviors. If you wait for your thinking mind to solve your problems, it might take all the time on the clock and not really produce anything productive.
So, what if we're given a limited amount of time and certain things do require what most people would consider to be thought to execute, but we're not actually thinking about that execution when it's happening? Or, I mean, can you explain that a little bit or clarify?
Well, if you think about you'll see very stressful events. Let's say the aftermath of the first bomb that kicked off the Eric Rudolph eventual manhunt and bombing at the Atlanta Olympics. There were two explosive devices set, the first to draw the attention of first responders and the second to kill them.
Right.
And when the second bomb went off, in the footage you can see all manner of responses. Some people just simply are startled. They jump up in the air and they don't do anything productive. But you also see people responding to the event as if it were a threat.
Right.
Or any to threat, getting ready to draw a pistol. Now, a pistol isn't a good response against a bomb, but it's a generally adaptive behavior. It helps some circumstances, helps quite a few circumstances, actually. And so those are folks who, under stress, when they were truly startled or ambushed, let's say, their response was generally adaptive, meaning it helped their situation out in some way. And so what the biggest fear, though, is people can actually think themselves out of that good, generally adaptive response. And you can do it by with thoughts like, you know, why is this happening to me? Or I can't believe this. When conscious thoughts like that are filling the mind, adaptive behaviors are generally not happening. And so it's a depth of knowledge and experience that's available for play. And the real threat is that the conscious mind can interrupt it from its intended function.
All right. Jack, you had something you wanted to...
My mother was actually there when that bomb went off. In the very famous, like, footage, she's standing right next to the cameraman.
Huh.
Wow. And she, I, you know, I've asked her about it several times because I always was curious. And she said, no, I had no idea what was going on. Like, she basically, a bomb went off, and that never entered her mind that that could happen. So she stood right there until someone grabbed her and was like, we need to get out of here. We need to run. We need to go. And then she was like, oh, yeah.
That's a good idea.
She'd get away from the bomb.
And that is a perfect example of someone who's above her shock threshold. The notion of a bomb going off in front of her, I guarantee, was not on her map of her life.
Yeah.
And so when it did, she's pressed so far up that scale of arousal above the shock threshold that nothing is going to happen at all in terms of function until someone says, hey, we need to get out of here. And it's like dropping a needle on a record. She will suddenly say, boy, are you right? This is terrible. We need to get away from it.
Huh.
And, but meanwhile, she was having thoughts. The thoughts were likely something like, I can't believe this. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. And that'll just get repeated, even though you would think that our, you know, animal instinct, unquote, would kick in and we'd run away from threats. If the threat is overwhelming enough, we won't even try to escape it, as strange as it sounds. You'll see news reporters and sometimes cameramen killed because of what's called the viewfinder effect. They'll be watching an event through the viewfinder of a camera as it kills them because they're engaged in it intellectually. Wow, look at that fire. Look at that tsunami. And don't recognize it as a life-threatening circumstance that actually involved them. So the power of the thinking mind is that it can all too often and really dangerously override survival systems. You wouldn't think that's possible, but it is.
So how do we build robust skill sets into our survival systems?
Well, recognizing the what we've baked into the system is really important. There was a really interesting event. I don't know if you guys recall it. Back in 2011, I think, where a highly ranked competitive shooter who also ran a firearms training school was involved in a shootout with some folks robbing a jewelry store that he owned or was involved in some way. And he basically, if I'm remembering the facts of this right, it happened in Florida. He rolls up on the jewelry store just as four armed robbers are leaving the store. And instantaneously engaged all four of these folks, first with a battle of demolition derby cars, and then with a gunfight. He got into a gunfight against four armed robbers with a great amount of shooting skill. He was a decorated competitive shooter, but what he was carrying was a single five-shot revolver. Now, was he decisive? Sure. Did he take action that could have solved his problem? Sure. But completely without recognition that he was absolutely unprepared in terms of equipment for that event. But in his mind, the equipment decision was completely divorced from his response set. So his response set was almost based on a picture of himself as, I imagine, a competitive shooter carrying an accurate, reliable gun that holds a lot of ammunition and a whole bunch of spare ammunition. But then on a separate track, he had made a decision about comfort and carryability. So he carried a little bitty revolver with hardly any bullets in it and no reserve ammo. So what you had there is a response set that was so robust, but a preparation set that was completely unsuitable to his response set.
Well,
so,
that, what,
by not recognizing he had baked into that system,
when
that
we,
response set.
We've actually got to end right there, but this is going to be an amazing segue into next week's show. So we will pick this up in the next episode. If you guys want to, you're going to have to wait because we're time traveling. But we'll talk about this more. Thanks for coming on today, William. We'll get started here again in a second. Make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. And hey, keep leaving those 5-star review on iTunes. We really appreciate it. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe. See you next week.